These crosses commemorate 8 lives lost to another mass shooting in America. Here in Allen, Texas, this Catholic church is near the scene of the murders and providing healing.
Reporter Mark Irons travels to Texas seeking answers from a Catholic perspective about preventing gun violence, what Catholic bishops are saying about this life issue.
This humble little black nun hidden away in a monastery is a catalyst for this. It's like a spark.
A small monastery in Missouri is flooded with visitors, coming to see for themselves the body of a nun remarkably preserved. We explore the phenomenon of Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster. For the first time in nearly 20 years, the United States has a new archdiocese. The new Archbishop of Las Vegas joins us to talk about Catholic expansion into his part of America's West.
Everybody goes through troubles and struggles. Everybody has. It doesn't matter what stage in life you are. And they'll happen again and again. But it's always important to have your faith during that time.
The deep faith her son had for Christ fed his desire to help others. We go to Ireland's Knock Shrine to hear the story of Donald Walsh, a teen inspiring life even after his own death. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
There's a lot that we should be doing to build a culture of life. As a church, we're called to a holistic response. We're called to kind of prayer and action. We're called to policy change and supporting victims.
Gun violence, mass shootings, and a society that holds fast to the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. The Catholic Church wades into a divisive issue that has no easy answers. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. Reports on mass shootings have intensified over the last decade. Wherever you turn, there's stories of yet another mass shooting. At malls, at schools, in parking lots, at places where people gather to celebrate. Just last weekend, over the 3-day Memorial Day holiday, the Gun Violence Archive reports there were 20 mass shootings, which left 16 people dead and more than 80 injured across at least 12 states. That includes this incident in Red River, New Mexico, where 3 people were killed and 5 others injured during a biker rally Saturday evening. Police say the shooting started after a confrontation between motorcycle gangs. And 911 audio captures bystander fears during another shooting in Hollywood Beach, Florida.
The shooting, I think somebody got hit.
You just heard the gunshot?
Yes, we see the guy. 2 people got hit right now. 2 people got hit. A lady and another lady got hit.
9 people were shot as beachgoers frantically ran for cover along the crowded boardwalk, which was packed with holiday visitors. Investigators say the gunfire erupted after an argument broke out between 2 rival groups. Of those injured, 4 were children, including 1 1-year-old baby. Catholic bishops have not been silent about the issue of gun violence. In fact, many have been quite vocal, especially as tragedy has struck in their own diocese. They argue protecting the innocent from gun deaths is very much a pro-life issue. Reporter Mark Irons goes from the halls of Congress to Texas to bring us this story.
We can do more to take the most dangerous weapons out of the hands of the most dangerous people.
The Democrats want to make it about the gun and not about the person.
You've heard the back and forth in the nation's capital, but just a few miles outside the halls of Congress, guns are no casual debate. In southeast Washington, D.C., we met Peace Rafay, who described the frequency of gun violence here.
Almost every second, every minute, we have gun violence everywhere. It's a very, serious problem.
We spoke with her as she was picking up her son, a 7th grader from St. Thomas More Catholic School. Peace said she and her son have both witnessed shootings in this part of the city. From inner city streets in Washington or Chicago to places you'd never expect.
This man had decided to go in and start just shooting families very randomly at a mall, and it's a mall that my family often goes to.
We spoke with Adriana Lewin a couple weeks after the city of Allen, Texas was shocked by a mass shooting. In early May, a gunman killed 8 people inside an outlet mall here. Not far from the mall, parishioners at St. Jude Catholic Church are grateful no one in their church community was harmed. But Lewin, a parishioner and professional counselor, is trying to help those coping with the nearby tragedy.
They're still dealing with the anxiety, not being able to sleep. I've had people say like they're very nauseated, they haven't eaten meals for over a week.
We've seen it in schools, churches, or shopping malls like this one in Allen, Texas. Scenes of mass murder leaving so many questions behind. Why did it happen, and what's next?
But the first action, and the strongest action, is prayer. It's the only thing that will give us peace in our heart.
Deacon Robert Holliday addressed the St. Jude congregation during a mass for healing after the murders in Allen. He says what's next begins right here.
We needed to lean on Jesus and let him be our comfort, and pray that everybody turns away from the violence and the hatred.
Looking at the latest available data, Pew Research Center analysis found more Americans died of gun-related injuries in 2021 than any other year on record. Statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention count 48,830 deaths that year. 54% of the gun deaths were suicide. 43% were murders.
All human life is sacred, right? And we have to address the threat to life that's posed by gun violence, whether that's a mass shooting, whether that's a homicide, whether that's a suicide.
Julie Bodner is a policy advisor in the Department of Justice, Peace, and Human Development at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. For decades, Catholic leaders have called for prayer and action to end gun violence. Going back to 1994, U.S. bishops published a pastoral letter saying, quote, "We have an obligation to respond. Violence in our homes, our schools and streets, our nation and world is destroying the lives, dignity, and hopes of millions of our sisters and brothers."
The evidence shows that reasonable gun control measures can save lives. But the thing is that the response must include some policy changes to address the plague of gun violence, right? That's part of this issue.
Bodner says none of the policy changes U.S. bishops have called for over the years would violate Second Amendment rights to gun ownership. She calls them reasonable measures, including a ban on assault-style weapons.
You know, these are guns that have, you know, that are designed to kill lots of people quickly. That's wrong for our country.
Democratic Congressman Wiley Nickel co-sponsors a bill that would ban assault weapons. From 1994 until 2004, a ban on those firearms existed in the U.S. There's an effort to outlaw them again.
Well, and I say this as someone who supports the Second Amendment. I'm a responsible gun owner.
Winning over Republican support will be the challenge. Less than a month after the Allen shooting, we caught up with Republican Congressman Scott Perry, who was concerned about debt ceiling negotiations at the time.
Congressman, would you like to see the ban on assault-style weapons return to this country?
We're here talking about the debt ceiling.
Well,
right?
Sure, but would you? Yeah. This is you
we're
know,
here to talk about the debt ceiling.
You can do both at the same time, right? I mean, you're a congressman. You're representing the needs of the people.
So what is your question?
My question is, there was a ban on assault-style weapons in this country for 10 years. Do you think
and
something like that should be brought back?
And of course, you know, if you have any clue, it did absolutely nothing.
But Julie Bodner says evidence gathered by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops shows when assault-style weapons are used for violence, more people are killed.
The shootings that involve a large capacity magazine resulted in 62% higher death toll.
The gun debate can be complex. There are questions about greater gun restrictions, vetting gun owners, and the high number of guns already in circulation, both legally and illegally. Lifelong D.C. resident Perry Nesmith is familiar with the city's history of gun-related crime. On a larger scale, he describes what he calls moral decay within society.
My opinion is that the church on a whole, no matter what the faith is, has kind of taken a back seat and kind of letting more secular things take over.
In Southeast D.C., we did find one campaign put on by a neighborhood council that doesn't ignore God. It's using his command in the appeal to end gun violence. Bright red signs planted along the streets read, "Thou shall not kill." But for now, one resident here told us it's still not safe enough for her young children to go outside.
My kids don't get to play outside or nothing like that. Like, I have to take them other places for them to play outside. Like, it's just uncomfortable.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
A recent mass shooting happened at a Christian school in Nashville. Six people, three young children, and three school staffers were killed in March in that tragedy that rocked the city. The three Catholic bishops of Tennessee joined together with more than 100 other religious leaders in the state to ask for common sense changes to Tennessee gun laws. Governor Bill Lee is planning to call the General Assembly into special session in August to consider tougher gun restrictions. Immediately after the shooting, he signed an executive order to strengthen background checks. We're joined now by one of those bishops, Bishop Mark Spalding of the Nashville Diocese. He was a signatory to a letter calling on Governor Lee and the legislature to enact tighter gun restrictions. Thank you for joining us today. We understand that this school shooting in Nashville, which was followed just 2 weeks later by a mass shooting that killed five at a bank in Louisville, Kentucky, felt very personal to you. Tell us about that.
Well, it was personal because both here in Nashville and back home in Louisville, where I grew up, people that were involved in the shooting, I had some connection through the parishes. Here we had a worker in one of our parishes that her grandchild was in the shooting and was killed. And back in Louisville, a parishioner was in the former parish that I was pastor. He was killed in that situation. So it touched close to the heart, and so it's very near and dear to me.
Well, we're very sorry for your loss. As a Catholic bishop then, as a man of God dedicated to the culture of life, what kind of challenges do you and the other bishops feel you have with secular policymakers when it comes to advocating for an end to gun violence?
Well, I think we see it in every discussion that's out there. There's extremes involved, and we would hope that there can be some kind of moderate, determined voice in the middle. And so that's where we're coming from. We are looking to the best of our ability to bring forth a legislation, with the governor being the leader on this project, to really give common sense laws around these issues and to help as best we can in this endeavor.
It sounds like a voice in the middle is kind of challenging when you serve in Tennessee, a culturally conservative state with a deep commitment to Second Amendment rights. What range of reactions do you get from parishioners in your diocese when you bring up the issue of common sense gun measures?
Well, as you can imagine, there's people all along the spectrum, but those who are on the edges, either one, were saying not enough, or two were saying too much. But we do try to hold that middle course, and I think we're being received overwhelmingly positively, but we do get our voices that go after us on either side of the extremes.
And on this issue that divides so many in our country, what is that solution that you're proposing, that you're fighting for?
Well, it's the governor's measure, as you mentioned in the lead up, and his effort is to truly look at the mental health of people with that may be going through a challenge, and to have some process or procedure in which a loved one, whether that be a parent, a spouse, a child, anyone, a good friend, that could see that that person is in a difficult situation in their life where they're not in a good place, and that if they have a tendency to suicide or are hurting others, that a process could be done where for a while those guns could be taken away, and that until that person is in a much better place that would be safe for themselves and for others.
So a mental health approach to these laws. Bishop Spalding, for a lot of Americans, this is a moment, yes, of deep division, but also of mistrust of institutions and their government. What pastoral words do you have for them as they consider both the Second Amendment as a protective measure, but also the value of these very important lives that are lost?
Well, let's look at the Declaration of Independence, you know, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And our church has been very much at the forefront of all of those rights that we hold near and dear. And the pro-life movement, of which our church has been a part of, yes, we do have concerns with institutions out there, but we've made a dedicated effort to put forward pro-life arguments to protect our children from womb to tomb, and we need to continue to do that and make that known throughout all of our ministries.
Have you found common cause with bishops around the country?
Very much so. You know, the signatures that we put on the bottom of that letter to the governor was mine, was the Bishop of Knoxville and the Bishop of Memphis, and we're united in this as well around the country. But it's going to be a long haul to make sure change takes place to protect children, especially from the violence of guns.
Well, we'll be praying for your efforts and also for those who are very fearful in those moments. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much as well.
There's much more ahead on EWTN News In Depth, including the story of a teen gone now for a decade who's still influencing others to cherish life, and the nun whose body after death was discovered in a remarkable state. We head to Missouri to explore the story that has captured headlines across the country.
Thousands of pilgrims descended upon this quiet abbey this Memorial Day weekend to see the remains of their Benedictine foundress, Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster. I'm Catherine Hadro in Gower, Missouri. That story coming up next.
It's hard to believe that she was buried for 4 years and that she looks as good as she does after
so well preserved.
Finding her. Yes, it's yes. Unbelievable.
This is just proof that God exists, that he is with us.
Thousands of pilgrims descend on a small monastery in rural Missouri, drawn to visit 4 years after her death by the religious community's foundress. They came to see what many have called potentially miraculous, though any confirmation of that will not be known for years. What happened by the soybean fields just north of Kansas City is nothing short of inspirational. As evidenced by the crowds, the Holy Spirit is alive as people search for the meaning of why Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster's exhumed body was so remarkably preserved. Reporter Catherine Hadro traveled to Missouri to talk to those so deeply touched by their experience.
Tucked away in rural Missouri, the Benedictines of Mary, Queen of Apostles, live a hidden life. Their abbey typically filled with angelic sounds of either song or silence. But in these past few weeks, there's been a new buzzing ballad of excitement on their country grounds.
We dropped everything to come here, changed all of our plans, booked a hotel immediately, and did not realize there's going to be this many people.
Thousands of pilgrims and curious spectators rearranged their Memorial Day weekend plans and descended upon Gower, Missouri, to see the unearthed body of the late Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster, foundress of the Benedictines of Mary, Queen of Apostles.
Wanted to be a part of this special thing that has happened.
You look at her face, her facial features are just so perfect.
Roughly 4 years after her death, the sisters exhumed their foundress's body on the feast of St. Louis de Montfort, so her remains could be reinterred in their church. The sisters were told to expect to find bones. After a few days of digging, they lifted up the simple wooden coffin and quickly noticed a massive crack down the middle of the lid.
And I realized, well, I could look in the crack with a flashlight just to see what do we have here? What am I going to see? So I looked and I kind of did a double take and I kind of stepped back. Did I just see what I think I saw? Because I think I just saw a completely full foot. And then I just, I see her foot.
The sisters say there was a layer of mold covering Sister Wilhelmina's body. It took about 2 weeks for them to gently and precisely clean. And when they did, what was hidden was now obvious. Sister Wilhelmina's body was remarkably preserved, including her habit.
I mean, of course they were marveling at the body. I mean, we had a coroner here and physicians and yeah. But then it kind of got to the habit and they were just dumbfounded. Dumbfounded. This is not possible. 4 years in a wet coffin, broken in with all the dirt, all the bacteria, all the mildew, all the mold, completely intact, every thread.
Word began to spread about the Missouri nun who was not embalmed, but appeared to be incorrupt. The people poured in.
This is probably one lifetime experience that you'll be able to see one of God's miracles.
This just gives us the proof to me that what I've been believing is real.
I've never seen an incorrupt person in person.
Travelers from both nearby and cross country waited in line under the hot Missouri summer sun to see Sister and touch her body. Sister Wilhelmina is now being kept in a glass display case where visitors can still see her.
I think it's just beautiful to see such a holy person.
Now that Sister Wilhelmina's body has been placed in a glass case here in the Abbey, visiting pilgrims are invited to take up to a teaspoon of dirt from her original gravesite.
Bishop James Johnston of Kansas City St. Joseph issued a statement that no official church process has been initiated to determine if Sister Wilhelmina is a saint or worthy of veneration. He said it's understandable if people are driven by faith to see her mortal remains in remarkable condition, but cautioned that, quote, visitors should not touch or venerate her body or treat them as relics.
The case of Sister Wilhelmina is fascinating.
Michael O'Neill, known as the Miracle Hunter, is host of EWTN's They Might Be Saints and author of Science and the Miraculous, How the Church Investigates the Supernatural.
This is a very rare case of a near perfectly preserved corpse.
O'Neill says there have been fewer than 200 cases of incorruptibility in the church. Incorruptibility is not an official sign taken by the church as a miracle for sainthood, but is a sign of God's grace shown upon a person.
It will never lead to a person's sainthood in a formal way, such as a miracle is used, but it can go in the sainthood file, you might say.
Mary Elizabeth Lancaster was born on Palm Sunday, 1924. She had a pious childhood and, according to her biography, had multiple mystical experiences as a little girl. She joined the Oblate Sisters of Providence in Baltimore as a young woman, taking on the name Wilhelmina when she made her vows. At 70 years old, Sister Wilhelmina founded the Benedictines of Mary, Queen of Apostles, in 1995, a constitutionally enclosed order with limited contact with guests and the outside world. The order is centered around St. Benedict's Ora et Labora, or prayer and work, and is best known for its chart-topping Gregorian chant albums. At the age of 95, after having lived 75 years under religious vows, Sister Wilhelmina died on the Vigil of the Ascension 2019. And now her hidden body and her hidden life is being shared with the world.
The first word that comes to my mind is lovable.
Oh, yes.
Just lovable.
In their first television news interview since Sister Wilhelmina's body was exhumed, Mother Abbess Cecilia Snell, the community's first abbess, and Sister Scholastica Radel tell us about their foundress, whom they knew for about the last 20 years of her life.
You know, you can think of a holy person as, you know, they just keep their hands folded and they say their prayers and they don't, you know, they never step out of line, so to speak. But boy, she had spunk, she had character.
The sisters say their foundress was also a master of poetry. The religious community published a biography of her, titling it God's Will. It was a theme of her life and the title of a beloved poem Sister Wilhelmina wrote and would frequently recite around the abbey to the rhythm of her cane hitting the ground. The sisters delivered it in their best Sister Wilhelmina impression.
God's will, God's will be done. Praise be the Father, praise be the Son. Praise be divine love, Lord, Holy Ghost. Praise be in union with the heavenly host.
A descendant of slaves, it's believed Sister Wilhelmina could be the first African-American to be found incorrupt.
Look at this woman. She is an African-American, and looking around at all her daughters, we're all white. We are all children of the same father. And she speaks to charity. I mean, this is a unifying moment for everybody.
Benedictines of Mary say Sister Wilhelmina found her primary identity in her vocation as a bride of Christ. While the fabric in the coffin disintegrated, her habit's fabric is surprisingly intact.
It's so appropriate because that's what Sister Wilhelmina fought for, mm-hmm. her whole religious life.
In her former community, it was a great heartache for her to go through the changes that occurred, especially between the 60s and the 70s, when her community lost, I believe, over 100 sisters, mm-hmm. right around the time that they were changing the habit. And she saw this as kind of a catalyst that the habit was signifying the spousal relationship with Christ, and that once you took that away or even compromised it, you were compromising life as a whole. She did die in her habit, mm-hmm. and we said that's so appropriate because she would have died for the habit. Mm-hmm.
While at this point we have more questions than answers, might Sister Wilhelmina be declared incorrupt? Might her life be considered saintly in the future? The Benedictine Sisters of Mary have one hope that fuels their faith, that what is now seen points us to the unseen.
I pray that every soul who comes here, or even isn't able to come, coming in spirit, will take away a spark of great hope.
Reporting from Gower, Missouri, Catherine Hadrow, EWTN News in depth.
A scholar and expert on Black Catholicism, Dr. Shannon D. Williams, joins us now to provide more context on why the story of Sister Wilhelmina is so important to church history beyond this specific moment. Dr. Williams is an associate professor of history at Dayton University. Thank you for joining us. Shannon, you wrote the first and I believe only full history of Black Catholic nuns in the United States called Subversive Habits. It's been out for a year, and you really understand the history of African-American nuns. So let's start with what comes first. When we think about Sister Wilhelmina's story, what makes her life's legacy so unique?
First off, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and to speak to the story and the ongoing story about Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster. She is in many ways representative of a very long and rich tradition of Black Catholicism in the United States, which has given rise to at least 8 historically Black Roman Catholic sisterhoods, the first successful of which was the Oblate Sisters of Providence, of which Sister Wilhelmina was a member for 53 years before she left to found her community, her Benedictine community, which is now in Missouri. This story is important for many reasons. So many of the Black women and girls who have entered religious life in the Roman Catholic Church from the United States can trace their lineage to the earliest days of the U.S. Catholic Church, reminding us that the church has always been racially diverse, that the African foundations of U.S. Catholicism and indeed American Catholicism are just as old as the European foundations. Indeed, in the case of Sister Wilhelmina, her family begins, and her family story begins in Missouri, which is one of the cradles of U.S. Catholicism and also one of the cradles of Catholic slavery. Sister Wilhelmina is a descendant of enslaved Black Catholics from St. Genevieve, Missouri. She was educated in Catholic schools in St. Louis, where she was born. She lived under a time of racial segregation, meaning that she was only allowed to enter Black Catholic schools. And then when she decided to enter religious life in the 1940s, she would have been barred, and she was in fact barred from the white sisterhoods ministering in the in Missouri, which led to her admission into the Oblate Sisters of Providence, who had ministered in Missouri since the late 19th century, but who were headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland, another cradle of American Catholicism.
Right.
So it's an amazing story.
And there were only 2 orders that were available for her to choose from at the time, right? There was one, the Oblates that she did join, that was for Hispanic and Black nuns and one other option. What does that mean then in reminding us of this history? What does this unconfirmed suspicion of her well-preserved body, what could it mean for Catholics in the Universal Church?
What I think it has the opportunity to do is to help us to bridge these racial divides that continue in our society. It is important to remember that the African-American sisterhoods were founded in response to the anti-Black and anti-Brown admissions policies of the nation's earlier European and white American communities. What's very significant about the African-American sisterhoods is that they were preserving the vocations of Black women and other women of color who were barred admission into white communities, that the African-American sisterhoods were always multi-ethnic, were always multilingual, because they are preserving the vocations of those who are barred from admission into communities of white communities, not only in the United States, but in Canada, Latin America, Central America, and the Caribbean. So these are always inclusive spaces, that they are the tradition that reminds us that we had to uphold what is the greatest teaching of our church, that all people were equal in the eyes of God. And so that tradition is still with us, and it comes out of the African-American Catholic community, who always understood that racism and any form of discrimination had no place within the Universal Catholic Church. So that matters, that when we tell Sister Wilhelmina's story, that we are telling that long trajectory of those Catholics who fought to make their church really truly Catholic.
And truly
and sincerely
reflective.
Catholic.
Yes, reflective of that universality.
Truly reflective,
for sure.
Truly inclusive. Absolutely.
And her story is remarkable, truly, truly special, because they were ministering to children. These orders were meant to give resources and love and education to Black children and minority children. Is this something that's typical of these orders?
Absolutely. So they are founded specifically because there was a moment in our history, in our church's history, in which Catholic schools did not always educate all of those on the margins. And so when we think about the Oblate Sisters of Providence and the Sisters of the Holy Family, which are the second successful community of African-American sisters and the second oldest in the modern Atlantic world, what we get are women who are, in the face of this unholy discrimination, upholding their faith and living their faith and saying that, yes, we are going to educate those children at the margin, both who are free and enslaved. And so that tradition of love, that tradition of faithfulness, that tradition of service in the service of God and understanding that all of God's children had a right to a Catholic education is very much a part of the story. It's a part of the story that Sister Wilhelmina came into and certainly contributed to as a member of the Oblate Sisters of Providence, but also what she took out of her community when she decided to found her own interracial community. That community is significant. We do not have many Roman Catholic sisterhoods in the United States that were founded as interracial communities outside of the African American sisterhoods. And so she herself is bringing that tradition of universal love, of universal respect back into the church. And that's certainly true for the Oblate Sisters of Providence, which gave rise to three additional Roman Catholic sisterhoods, two of which were predominantly white or now interracial, and then another historically Black sisterhood. So this is in many ways a remarkable story because it reminds us that we cannot tell Sister Wilhelmina's story without also bringing with her this great tradition of Black Catholicism that has always understood and upheld the church's greatest teaching that all lives matter.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Williams.
Thank you for having me.
Ahead on EWTN News In Depth, Catholicism expands in the American West. We talk to the new Archbishop of Las Vegas. A major league pitcher demands respect for the Catholic Church after a controversial decision by the Los Angeles Dodgers. And what the Vatican has to say about barbs, snark, and vitriol on social media. Top headlines are next in the Week in Review. An agreement on the debt ceiling avoiding an economic crisis tops our Week in Review. Shortly before midnight on Thursday, in a 63-36 vote, the Senate passed a bill that raises the nation's debt limit. The agreement suspends the $31.4 trillion debt limit until January 2025 and cuts spending for 2 years.
The bill is passed.
It comes with just days to spare before Monday's deadline, the date Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned the U.S. could run out of money to pay all of its bills on time. The deal will keep non-defense spending flat in 2024 while slightly raising military spending. It also imposes new work requirements for Americans on food stamps and other federal assistance programs. Medicare and Medicaid programs were left untouched. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the bill will reduce the deficit by $1.5 trillion over the next decade. And a rare event in the church. The first new archdiocese in the United States in nearly 20 years. Pope Francis announced this week he is elevating the rapidly growing Diocese of Las Vegas to an archdiocese. The number of Catholics in the Diocese of Las Vegas has tripled since 1995, from 250,000 Catholics to 750,000. With this announcement, Las Vegas is the 24th Latin Archdiocese in the U.S. The United States officially has 34 Latin archdioceses. The last time a new archdiocese was made was the region of Galveston-Houston in Texas in 2004. The new Archbishop of Las Vegas, His Excellency George Leo Thomas, joins us now to talk about this exciting development for the church. Welcome to our show and congratulations on this momentous change. Is this something that you suspected would be happening?
Well, yes and no. The growth has been exponential in the 5 years I have been here. More importantly, I'd say the dynamism of the church has been the real standout feature. And I know that that has come to the attention of the Holy See, certainly to the attention of the USCCB. So the process has been sub secreto for a number of months, but there's never a guaranteed outcome that we would be an archdiocese or remain a diocese. I received word May 22nd, the Holy Father had raised us to a metropolitan see and gave me a new title. So I must tell you, the news has been remarkably well received by our people, and the priests are over the moon.
The Diocese of Las Vegas, along with Reno and Salt Lake City, were all part of San Francisco's ecclesiastical province. Now Reno and Salt Lake City will be moved to the province under the Archdiocese of Las Vegas. What does that relationship mean?
Well, for the last several years, we've been part of the metropolitan Archdiocese of San Francisco, and that is based on a historic reality when we were Reno, Las Vegas. Reno and San Francisco are fairly proximate. And so as we became our own diocese just 27 years ago now, it was a little bit of a stress to have our metropolitan see so far away, an 8-hour trip from here. Also, as our own growth took place, so too, the same phenomenon has taken place in Reno and in Salt Lake City. They're growing exponentially as well. So it's just, it's a logical configuration. We definitely, we work so closely with Reno this year with legislative issues especially, but we have so much in common as well with Utah. So it's a logical change, a very natural change, one well received by Bishop Muggenborg in Reno and Bishop Solis in Utah.
Well, before we get to the legislative issues, really quick, what does that composition, that fastest growing immersion of new people, what does that look like? What does it mean?
Well, I came here 5 years ago. I was the Bishop of Montana in Helena for 14 years, and I received a call from the nuncio in 2018, and he said to me, the diocese has grown too complex to send a new bishop. And so we're asking you to leave your diocese and to move to Vegas. I said to him, Your Excellency, what are the complexities? And the first thing he said was a paucity of clergy and seminarians adequate enough to serve the population, the exponential growth, the need to open new parishes, new schools, the need to strengthen the infrastructure of the diocesan administration. So it gave me a fairly substantial list. Mm. And when I arrived here, I've told people I knew only two people in the greater Vegas Valley. I have a cousin here, and I knew Bishop Pepe very well. My cousin made the remark, said, you will know Vegas like everybody else, but you'll discover Las Vegas. And what I discovered is a very vibrant community, very family-oriented, very deep faith, and the parishes were just burgeoning. So everything that I have learned over the last 5 years has been just a great surprise, such a dynamic, life-filled church.
Real quick, I know that you've been very clear on Eucharistic coherence and abortion, and I want to make sure that we understand what that looks like now with the Archdiocese and with Nevada's new rule on abortion tourism that was just passed a few days ago.
With our legislature, I did the invocation there probably 6 or 8 weeks ago, and spoke with a lot of different legislators. And it's very clear that the diocese also aligned with Reno, but also very much working with the LDS, are very clear that life is sacred from the moment of conception till natural death, that we will systematically oppose laws and measures that weaken that vision of human life and its dignity. So we're on the record, and in some ways I know that it makes legislators very, very nervous, but it's so important to have a prophetic edge in the protection of human life.
Thank you so much for joining us, and Viva Arch Vegas.
Thank you so much, and blessings.
Thank you. And with the expansion of one archdiocese comes the shrinking of another. The Archdiocese of St. Louis announced this week it will reorganize and cut the number of parishes within its jurisdiction because of dwindling mass attendance and priest shortage. Archbishop Mitchell Brzezanski told the Catholic News Agency while nearly 1,000 people enter the church through baptism each year in the Archdiocese, about 5,000 Catholics leave, many after high school or college. In August, the Archdiocese will merge several parishes, going from 178 to 134, a drop of 44 parishes, reflecting the loss of Catholics in the city, many of whom have moved to outlying areas and redistribute priests accordingly. A Catholic pitcher in Major League Baseball is speaking out. Following the Los Angeles Dodgers' controversial invitation to an anti-Catholic group to participate in its Pride Night celebrations. The group named the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence call themselves trans nuns. This drag group states its mission is to support LGBTQ groups, but performs obscene reenactments of Jesus' passion, sexualizes Catholic sacraments, and mocks all forms of Catholic imagery while providing support services to these communities. The Dodgers originally disinvited the group, only to reinvite them once they faced backlash from LGBTQ advocates. Trevor Williams tweeted out a statement condemning the Dodgers' decision, writing, "As a devout Catholic, I am deeply troubled by the Dodgers' decision to invite and honor a group that makes a blatant and deeply offensive mockery of my religion." He asks the Dodgers to reconsider their association with the group, and he even calls on Catholics to reconsider their support of an organization that allows this type of mockery of its fans to occur. EWTN News In Depth is interviewing Trevor Williams about his defense of the faith. We will bring you our exclusive interview on our program airing on June 16th, the day the Dodgers celebrate Pride Night at Dodger Stadium. This week, the Vatican shared its recommendations for Catholics on social media. The pastoral reflection encourages the faithful to be loving neighbors online. The Vatican's Dicastery for Communication held a press conference on the document on Monday. The reflection discusses information overload, being an influencer, and witnessing to Christ in digital culture. The Dicastery advises Christians to be reflective, not reactive, on social media, and to avoid pitfalls like aggressive, negative, and hateful speech online. The recommendations are for all Catholics, but especially directs bishops and high-profile lay leaders to avoid causing division on social media.
The bishops, like the others, I think also need time, discernment, to reflect on their experience. It is the only way to move forward and to reflect on the road taken and to see what steps or what changes, to have a fairer way of acting.
The text is not meant to provide guidelines, but to promote reflection on how Christians foster meaningful relationships on social media. It also encourages Catholics to carve out time to detach from the digital world. Health news about former First Lady Rosalynn Carter announced this week by the Carter Center in Atlanta. Mrs. Carter has been diagnosed with dementia. The 95-year-old is considered one of our nation's foremost mental health advocates, talking frequently about mental illness and caregiving before, during, and after her time in the White House. A spokesperson said Mrs. Carter continues to live happily at home with her husband, former President Jimmy Carter, enjoying springtime in Plains, Georgia, and visits from their family. The Carters' marriage is the longest in presidential history. Next month, the couple will celebrate their 77th wedding anniversary. Just 3 months ago, the Carter Center announced the 98-year-old former president has entered hospice care at his home. The Carter Center said it hopes sharing the Carters' news about the dementia diagnosis, as well as the need for hospice care, will raise public awareness and lead to important conversations at the kitchen table and in doctors' offices around the country.
God has given me this challenge, like, but I may be used as a symbol for other people to appreciate life more.
Next, combating mental illness that leads to suicide. The remarkable story of a teenager whose short life has inspired thousands of others to hold on to theirs. EWTN News In Depth will be right back. Jesus is always close to you. Pope Francis shared those words of encouragement this week with young cancer patients and their families at the Vatican. The group traveled from Poland to receive the Holy Father's blessing. He gave each child a rosary, and together they all prayed a Hail Mary. Pope Francis told the children that God is with them in their suffering, and our Blessed Mother will never abandon them. An Irish teen whose battle against cancer captured the attention of his countrymen in a dramatic way was just remembered on the 10th anniversary of his death. The famous Knock Shrine in Ireland hosted hundreds of young people who came to honor Donal Walsh and his mission to speak out against suicide. Reporter Colm Flynn has Donal's story.
I'm Donal. I'm 16, and on the 15th of February 2012, I was diagnosed with cancer for the second time in my life.
This is the story of a young man from Ireland called Donal Walsh.
Donal liked to pray the Rosary and the Divine Mercy and the Jesus, Mary and Joseph prayer. There were his prayers. And so I said, look, we'll say the Rosary, Donal. And while he couldn't say it, he was aware of it. And he would nod to say that he knew what he was going on.
From the ages of 12 to 16, Donal battled with cancer, eventually losing the battle on Sunday the 12th of May, 2013.
After about 2 minutes after taking the communion, I noticed he slipped a bit. And I called for Jimma and Finbar to come up.
Up the stairs, into the room, and Donal took 3 breaths. Gone.
I just kissed him his last breath, and that was it, he was gone.
And you knew he was passing away?
He was going, yeah.
Yeah.
It was just minutes after the prayer.
What's that moment like?
Awful. Awful. I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
But a few weeks before he died, Donal had done something remarkable.
My first guest tonight is 16 years old and he doesn't expect to live much longer. He wanted to be here tonight because he has something very important to say about the value of life.
That made the entire country of Ireland stop in its tracks.
God has given me this challenge, but I may be used as a symbol for other people to appreciate life more.
Today at the Shrine of Knock in Ireland, over 2,000 school students have gathered from across the country.
It is wonderful that you're here, and you're here for a reason. Each and every single one of you here today are here for a reason, and that reason is to take something from today.
The students then listen carefully to a number of speakers talking about different issues that affect the world today, in particular, mental health. One of the key speakers is Irish football star Aidan O'Mahony.
Aidan O'Mahony went into his 5-year-old self, kept everything to myself because I kind of saw myself that when I played with Kerry, I played in the edge or I played in the line, I need to be seen as that person. I couldn't drop my guard. And as Donal said there, ask for help or share that pain you're going through.
The young people are encouraged to always speak openly about their mental health and, if ever suffering, to talk to someone about it and get help. This is part of the legacy of 16-year-old Donal Walsh, who even though he passed away from cancer, his dying message was powerful. Finbar and Elma are his parents. Elma, remind us, who was Donal Walsh?
Donal Walsh was our son. He was an ordinary young fella, cheeky. He loved life, he loved football, he loved rugby, he loved sport. He was like any young teenager. Unfortunately, when he was 12, he got cancer.
When we were told he was terminal, we turned around and sort of said, why us? And he changed his story, his question, to why not me?
And he decided he wasn't going to let cancer dictate whatever was left of his life, that he wanted to do something.
As Donal battled multiple tumours, with his future hanging in the balance, unrelated, a number of young people in the area took their own lives. And this had a profound effect on Donal, who was fighting to live.
There was people in County Kerry that were young people that were taking their lives. And he thought that maybe if they got a little help, that maybe they might be around today when he wasn't going to get the chance.
And here he was, and he'd give anything for an extra day.
Would you please give a big welcome to Donal Walsh.
With only a few weeks left to live, Donal, at only 16 years of age, went on national TV to share his story, to try and emphasise the value of life.
It hurts me to see them think about it, to see it among their friends. But It kills me because I'm here fighting for my life for the third time. I've no say in anything. And I'm still here, waking up every day. And then they think that they have a problem and this might be a solution. These people have to realize that there is help everywhere, that this is never going to be an answer. Like, I just see maybe if I'm meant to be a symbol for people to appreciate life, it mightn't be just suicide in particular, but just to appreciate life more in general, then I'd be happy to die if that's what I'm dying for, but.
Okay.
Donal passed away 4 weeks later. He spoke on TV for all of 19 minutes, but his message had a profound effect on people.
He had great faith.
Where do you think that came from, his deep faith?
He had a remarkable faith. It was kind of innate to him. It was just in him. A lot of people ask me that question. It's hard to explain, but it was just in him. It was just part of Donal.
After his death, his parents started the Donal Walsh Live Life Foundation, which to date has raised over €500,000 for various charities, all promoting life. And once a year, students meet here at the Basilica of Knock in County Mayo to celebrate Mass, be inspired and encouraged by guest speakers, and be reminded of the value of life.
What do you want your son's legacy to be? What do you want the 2,500 young people to leave here today with?
To know that they're loved, to know that their lives are precious and delicate, and nobody knows what tomorrow will bring, but just to appreciate things that they have in life.
And for the students, well, they can relate to Donal, a teenager their own age who displayed such strength and courage.
I think a lot of people would be very kind of afraid of the idea of terminal illness, but his bravery, he was able to kind of endure through so much hardship and still have faith, and that's inspiring to people.
I think that it is very inspirational. He creates this beacon of hope for the youth, keeps his hope alive.
Donal was only 16. Wow. He's a 16-year-old, but some effect. If you can speak out and you have a positive, message.
You can make a change.
You can make a change, yeah.
You can make
you
a
can
difference.
Affect
you can make a change
world,
in 19 minutes,
you know, yeah.
10 years ago.
If I'm meant to be a symbol for people to appreciate life, then I'd be happy to die. If that's what I'm dying for, I'll be happy, you know?
A beautiful example of confidence in God and finding purpose in suffering. If you would like to find out more about Donal Walsh's mission to combat suicide, visit the Foundation's website at donalwalshlivelife.org. We'll be back with some beautiful music played this week in Rome, all in honor of Religions United. Concert highlights from the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra up next. The Catholic Church has always held a special relationship with those of the Jewish faith. Pope Benedict called them our elder brothers. This week, the Vatican celebrated the anniversary of its diplomatic relations with Israel through music. The theme for the night was Religions United in Music. The Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra performed in the Papal Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls, marking 30 years since Israel and the Vatican vowed to work together to defend religious freedom and combat all forms of anti-Semitism. Iconic melodies from composers like Bach and Schubert filled the basilica. We close our program today with a portion of the Israeli Orchestra's concert. I'm Montse Alvarado. We hope to see you again next week, same time, for another edition of EWTN News In Depth. Now enjoy these sights and sounds in our Images of the Week.